Question. Good afternoon. Please be seated. We are here in the matter of Ryder versus Miranda, case number 54939. Counsel, are you ready to proceed?
We are, Your Honor.
Very well.
Good afternoon. May it please the court. Can I have 2 minutes for rebuttal, please?
Yes. And counsel, I believe you had a representation that you were going to make with respect to one of the former parties.
We do, Your Honor. I've been asked to disclose to the court that Dr. Peoples has been dismissed from this action. I believe that was back in June of 2009 that dismissal was done.
Thank you.
That was with prejudice.
That was with prejudice, yes.
Thank you.
The case law governing the issues before the court in this matter are relatively clear. We have the Young case, the Stubley case, GNLV, and Fleur, and they outline that the district court has a heightened level of scrutiny in dismissing an action. The facts of this case are in dispute, and that was the issue I had with the district court. There was a clear discrepancy in what was represented to the court from the defendants regarding the nature of discovering this case compared to what was alleged by the plaintiffs as to the facts of this case. That issue was brought up to the district court when we did a motion for findings of facts and conclusions of law after the case was dismissed. And the court at that time chose not to have an evidentiary hearing. I believe that the evidentiary hearing was important and it was abuse of discretion not to hold it. The Fleur case that I referenced indicates that if there is any dispute at all as to the facts of a case that influences the Young factors, that the district court has to address the relevant factors in an evidentiary hearing. And it wasn't done in this case. The salient question I think that's before the court is this. Were the Young factors met?
Did you argue in the district court that you were deprived of an evidentiary hearing as part of the court's sanctioned determination?
Well, my understanding that the evidentiary hearing wasn't triggered until the court learned of the discrepancy. The discrepancy was raised for the first time in the motions to amend. We didn't know at the time of the hearing in August when the case was dismissed what the other side was going to be arguing as representations of the discovery in the case. But we pointed out to the court after that there was substantial discrepancy based on the correspondence between the parties as to compared to what was alleged by the defendants as a basis for the dismissal.
Well, could you answer my question, whether it was at the time of the hearing or thereafter?
Did you request an
evidentiary hearing?
Sure, Justice Hardesty. My understanding that it was not requested at the time of the hearing where the dismissal was made. I don't believe it was requested after that. My understanding, I'm not a district court judge, my understanding is once those discrepancies are raised to the court can then sua sponte order an evidentiary hearing to clarify those issues.
Are they obligated then to sua sponte order a hearing?
The Fleur case says it's a mandatory. The Fleur case doesn't go into whether it has to be requested or not, but the Fleur case says it is mandatory. Once there's an issue that arises where the district court learns of a discrepancy in the facts of the case that affect the Young factors, then an evidentiary hearing must be had.
Even after they've made their Young determination?
Fleur, there's a Young determination.
So what about finality? When do we ever end these cases?
Well, I think you end when those issues are raised to the court, and the court then has an evidentiary hearing and offers or proof are made to the district court judge where the judge can say, either I got it right or I need to learn more and the case shouldn't have been dismissed. And especially in this case, when representations are made that completely betray the correspondence in the case and how discovery progressed, an evidentiary hearing was in order in this case, and it was an abuse of discretion.
How were those representations brought to the court's attention?
They were in the motions to amend the findings of fact and conclusions of law.
Okay.
The two salient questions I think are before the court are the Young factors met, and the other thing is...
Well, did you even cite Fleur in the motions to amend the findings of fact and conclusions of law?
You know, Justice Hardesty, I'm not aware whether they did or not. If it was only in a footnote, not in the body of the text.
I didn't see that.
I don't know if it was in a footnote. I know it wasn't cited in the actual
body.
Uh-huh. Okay.
The other question besides the Young factors, a subset of that is, in this June 2009 hearing where Judge Johnson says, you have to have this deposition within 30 days. Judge Johnson goes through all the alleged discovery abuses up to that time. It's a motion to dismiss, and she makes a determination that the discovery abuses that are raised by the defendant don't rise to the level that necessitate a motion to dismiss. So the question then becomes, is there something that happens between that motion hearing and the ultimate dismissal of the case 2 months later that justifies the dismissal? Does something tip over the iceberg? And what happens in the meantime is that a deposition is scheduled on July 3rd. And I think the events leading up to that deposition are the most critical in the case. This hearing from Judge Johnson, where she orders the case to go forward with a deposition in 30 days, happens on June 15th. On June 16th, Miranda, the defendant, requests dates from us for the deposition. We write a letter to them on June 19th, and this is all in the appendix to the court. We write a letter on June 19th that says, we have no issue going forward on the deposition, but we want to limit the scope. Now, the way this works in district court, and I'm sure your honors are familiar with this, is that if it's a second deposition in a case, the discovery commissioners in the 8th Judicial District have ruled, as far back as I know, 7 years at least, that if it's a second deposition, the only things you can inquire into are the care and treatment in a personal injury case that happened from the time of the last deposition forward. And I've litigated that issue with Commissioner Bigger as well as Commissioner Bull. What we were requesting from the defendants is, because this was their second deposition of the writers and they'd already spent 8 hours with them in the first depo, that they limit the deposition accordingly.
How much notice of that deposition did they have?
How much notice? The fax was sent to us on June 19th, but was less than 15 days notice, even by fax. We didn't agree to accept service by fax. The mail got to us on, the 22nd. So it was insufficient notice under our Rule 30. And that's one of the issues that we had in the case. We were trying to obviously get this deposition moving forward.
But wait, doesn't that belie the findings that were made in Judge Johnson's order, where on June 15th, when in fact the motion to dismiss Dr. Peoples was actually to be heard, but ultimately agreed to dismiss him, didn't she say in that hearing that these depositions were to be scheduled within 30 days, and then there's some exchange over the next couple of days, but no one mentions even then that the scope of the deposition should be limited? Aren't you playing a little bit fast and loose with the facts?
Well, Justice Sata, on June 19th is when we write this letter to limit the scope of the deposition. So it's right after the hearing's on June 15th. We write the letter on June 19th. On June 24th, we get a letter back saying, we're not clear on the scope. What do you mean? We outline it again for them more clearly the same day. During the next day, which is June 25th, we ask, instead of doing a motion practice on this, I already know how the discovery commissioner is going to rule on this issue because I've litigated it already and we told them that. And we said, let's get Commissioner Bulla on the line for a conference call, which is something she does for straightforward discovery issues to save the motion practice. They refused to do that. We file our motion for protective order to limit the scope on the 25th. Commissioner Bulla signs it because it's on OST. It gets signed on the 29th.
So the record again is incorrect because the order says you filed that on the 29th, not the 25th.
It was submitted on the 25th, and Commissioner Bulla signed it on the 29th. We had to wait for that OST signature. She signed it on the 29th and then set the hearing for July 1st.
So the court's order is wrong. It says that it was filed on that day.
It is. In worst case scenario, even though we haven't agreed to go forward in this deposition, it was unilaterally set without any regard to whether counsel could be there or the plaintiff could be there, and it was set without insufficient notice, and it was also set on a judicial holiday, which is July 3rd, where we would have no court guidance.
Wasn't it set after several attempts were made to get a date that was agreeable to all?
No, Justice Perigieri, it wasn't. Supposedly there was a letter sent on June 16th saying, can we have dates? We said in our letter on June 19th, that's fine, but we need to get the scope issue cleared.
So the record at least the court order is wrong again. It says that on June 16th, their dates were requested, but then no response was received.
The response, we replied within 3 days, and by the time we replied on June 19th, they had already unilaterally set the depositions. The issue that I was concerned about with the deposition set on July 3rd, besides the time period, and we could work around the 15 days to get this thing done, it was that it was on a judicial holiday. So we were going to get no guidance from the court for any discovery objections that we had, and it was going to be an exercise in futility. That's why I requested to get Commissioner Bulla on the line so she could iron out the scope issues before that, which they refused to do.
And how about the fact that, notwithstanding the court's order that said that these depositions needed to be taken within 30 days, they certainly did not go forward on the 3rd of July, but they also did not take place any time within that 30-day window.
And you're correct, Justice Sada. What happened is that Commissioner Bulla had a family emergency, and she called our office on the 30th of June, so it's a day after she signed the OST, a day before the hearing was scheduled, and she said she had to be out of the state for a few days. On the same day, June 30th, we write a letter again that's in the appendix. It says, we need to get these scope issues ironed out. It doesn't make sense to go forward on the 3rd. We're more than willing to participate. We know that it has to be done by the 16th, but let's get Commissioner Bulla on board with this so we can have this deposition go forward without any hangups. On June 3rd, July 3rd, they show up for the non-appearance on the judicial holiday and take the non-appearance. On July 9th, Commissioner Bulla comes back in town. Now, we still have a week before the deadline. We write a letter on July 9th. We made attempts. We got Commissioner Bulla on the phone to take care of this discovery dispute as to the scope. They wouldn't get on the phone with her. They refused. So we told her this is a moot issue. We'll just set this hearing on the scope in the OST course again because she had bumped it back. And we wrote a letter that day on July 9th documenting how they wouldn't get on the phone with Commissioner Bulla to resolve the scope issue and also reiterating, we've only got a week left. We can get this thing done. We're going to make ourselves available on a shortened time. Whatever you need us to do, we'd like to get the scope issue done first.
Counsel, would you agree with me, however, we spent a lot of time on this one scheduling of depositions, but would you agree with me, I think, as Justice Perigary pointed out, that this was not the sole discovery issue or violation that occurred in this case?
You know, I agree in the sense that if there was a discovery violation, in my opinion, Justice Sada, there was one, and that was in March 2007 when people scheduled a deposition that nobody attended, and that's because my office failed to schedule it. I didn't know to go, the plaintiffs didn't know to go, and we missed that. Every other scheduling of a deposition that ended up to be vacated was done at my request because of scheduling issues that I had, whether it be taking out-of-state orthopedic surgeons or doing trials.
Doesn't go all the way back to the first set of interrogatories that were set and requests for production of documents and requests for an authorization for release.
That was a month prior to me getting on the case. We got on the case in March 2007, and what happens is I find out there's a month-old discovery, respond to it the same week. There's a medical authorization that they point to and say, well, you didn't sign the med off. Well, that's because the med off wasn't open-ended, and I called them 2 weeks after I got on the case and said, you have to have a limiting date. You can't go back forever, and you can't go into psychological issues. That's the ruling of Commissioner Beecroft, Commissioner Bull, as well as Commissioner Bigger. They limited the date, and the issue got resolved. That's not a discovery abuse, and that's just good practice from them trying to get a med off to something longer or more expensive than what they can get into. Now, As far as other depositions or not, other than that March 2009 deposition that wasn't calendared in my office, every other deposition, almost all of them were unilaterally set without any regard to my calendar. The Ryders wanted me to be at their deposition.
So there was no attempt to try and schedule with you at all?
The only one that was scheduled with us, other than this one that they asked for dates in 2009, was the one in 2008 in the summer when we met with Commissioner Bulla. And she said, I want you guys to have a deposition in 30 days. Now, we gave dates in that. They asked for dates. We gave dates. We gave dates within the 30 days. It didn't work with Ms. Everhardy, or there was another a firm on the case as well. It didn't work with them. We couldn't get dates consolidated together between us. Ms. Everhardy proposed that we take the deposition after the 30-day window. We gave dates and met our obligation to try to get it done within the 30 days. And I'm amenable to taking it outside the 30 days, but it's not a discovery abuse by plaintiff to do that. I mean, if it's a discovery abuse, it's a discovery abuse of all parties involved. But we have responded to discovery throughout the case. We've signed MedOffs whenever they come up. There's $200,000 in medical bills on a rear-end accident. And we've actively ran this case with multiple experts involved. And what it comes down to, if that is an abuse, that I missed a deposition, or that I asked for professional courtesy to reschedule depositions, then does that justify under Young, one of the factors, and I think it's a prime factor, is should the plaintiff suffer for that? Should they suffer the harm of counsel decision-making? It's not just that, you know, there's an overarching concern to have a case heard on its merits, but the writers at no time have failed to participate in this case, whether it's discovery or depositions. When depositions have been reset, it's been at the request of counsel. I vacated Miranda's deposition 4 times in 2007. That just happens in practice.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Ms. Eberhardy.
Good afternoon, Justice Hardesty, Seda, and Justice Paradori. I represent Joe Miranda, and under Young, this court has given inherent powers to the district court to dismiss cases where there's abusive litigation tactics, and that is what happened here. That is what the court did. First, I want to address the fact that plaintiff never asked for an evidentiary hearing ever, and it was not. He never cited, I call it Nevada Power, that Fleur case, never cited Nevada Power in the district court, and he never cited Nevada Power in this court. He did cite it in his reply brief, but that was just for the proposition that you have to use the heightened standard when you are reviewing what the district court did. He did not cite it for the proposition that they get an evidentiary hearing. So I just want to get that on the record. The evidentiary hearing, and I just want to distinguish that case and why I don't think that they are entitled to an evidentiary hearing. Not only did they not ask for it, but in the Nevada Power case, there was an actual dispute regarding that order in Nevada Power. Nevada Power thought they had abided by the discovery order. There was an actual dispute. They thought that they were within the order when they tore down the barriers or whatever and destroyed the evidence. And so there was a dispute, and they had asked for an evidentiary hearing, and the district court said, no, you're not going to get one. There's no dispute here. It would be futile. So that they asked for the hearing, and they did not get one in that case. In this case, they never asked for one, and there was no dispute regarding the facts of this case. Plaintiff's counsel and whether the abuses were done by plaintiff's counsel or the plaintiffs, at this point, I don't think it really matters. It happened. They missed their depositions, and they violated the district court order, which was to pay a sanction of $2,500 and to sit for the deposition within 30 days. We seem to forget about that sanction, and they don't address it in the brief. That sanction was not paid on time. That sanction was not paid a day late, 2 days late, but it was paid 2 weeks late or a day before our motion to dismiss. That's when they paid the sanction. They didn't pay it on the day that it was due, which was due on July 19th. 30 days after the June 16th hearing. They didn't pay that sanction, and they didn't appear for their deposition within the 30 days that they were supposed to. The deposition was not unilaterally set. We sent a letter on June 16th to both counsel for the writers and counsel for Dr. Peoples, because at that point in time, although Dr. Peoples, they had given oral representation that he was going to be dismissed from the case, he had not formally been dismissed. So we sent letters to both Dr. People's counsel and to the Writers Council. Give us dates. We're going to reset the plaintiff's depot. We have 30 days. We got word back from Dr. People's counsel on days that they could appear for the deposition. We never heard back from plaintiff's counsel. And what I'm understanding him to say is that what they wanted to do was clarify the scope of the deposition before they gave us the dates that they could appear. Well, the time to clarify the scope of the deposition was when the court ordered the deposition. They're not going to clarify the scope. It's the court that's going to clarify the scope. They're not going to tell me what the scope is. It's the court that's going to tell me what the scope is. And so they wanted to clarify the scope. They needed to file a protective order if that's what they wanted to do. And they didn't do it. I wrote to them and I told them, the court gave 30 days, and if it's not done in 30 days, I can renew my motion, and I am going to renew my motion. I wasn't mixing words there. I told them I was going to do that.
But at this point, Ms. Eberhardy, would you agree with me that while we're focusing on what appears to be, you know, this June to July period, hadn't there been years of discovery abuses leading up to, and I'm not criticizing counsel because I recognize that he was not on the case from the beginning, but nonetheless, isn't that also what the judge was looking at when she made her decision?
Yes, Your Honor. There was discovery abuses from the very beginning. We had problems from day one, and I call them like antiquated discovery issues because these were issues that you would see back in the day where people didn't want to sign medical authorizations, and I disagree with what counsel said. Our medical authorizations were HIPAA-compliant medical authorizations that were 5 years. That's all. And he is incorrect. And what he represented to this court, we gave them a 5-year HIPAA-compliant medical authorization, which they refused to sign. We had to file a motion to compel. Every time we asked them for discovery, the due dates for the discovery in the beginning seemed to be tied to when they switched counsel. And they switched counsel in the beginning twice. And then they got plaintiff's counsel, and then we had to actually file a motion to compel to get we had to put it on calendar for us to get the actual signed medical authorizations. Once we got those signed medical authorizations, we took the motion off. And, you know, it's the beginning of the litigation. He's the third counsel. We are going to cut new, we're going to, you know, it's common courtesy. We did that. We didn't know what we were up against. But from there, The discovery abuses kept going on. They missed 8 depositions. That their depositions were noticed 8 times, and they were not unilaterally noticed. And if counsel is saying that they weren't noticed by his calendar, well, that's not because we didn't try to get it noticed. We noticed it by plaintiff's calendar, whether plaintiff's counsel gave us his calendar dates or some other attorney in their office calendar dates, I don't know. But it was not just, you know, we're just going to set the depo dates. And there's correspondence. It's in the record. And it goes back 8 times. And every single time, they just called up and canceled. Or they were just not going to appear. And the thing is, the first couple of times, you're like, okay, I understand. You have an emergency. Something comes up, and again, you know, you practice for a number of years. Things like that happen. You have a caseload, and you tend to just okay, that it's okay. You forget. You know, you basically turn the other cheek and you let things go. Well, this happened one too many times, and when it finally got to the point, what was happening then? Is that there is this unwritten rule. We set the depo, Well, what they wanted to do was take our client's depo first, after we had originally set their depo. Well, there's an order.
Is this the July 3rd depo?
No, this is, I'm sorry, I lost you. I'm jumping all over. I'm going back to the way back in the beginning.
Okay.
And so there was all this confusion as to they wanted to take our client's depo out of order, et cetera. And so we ended up agreeing to that to just get the discovery moving. And even with that, they still wouldn't agree. And we ended up having to file our first motion to compel, which was filed, or our first motion to dismiss, which was filed in front of the discovery commissioner. That was when we had ended up having the first depo, which was done in August. And contrary to what plaintiff's counsel is saying, which he's saying that they were deposed for 8 hours, I actually went back yesterday to figure it out to see, because I'm like, 8 hours, that seems like a long time. 3 hours, I went and looked to see exactly how long they actually were deposed. And Mrs. Ryder was deposed 3 hours. She had to take a break every 15 minutes. Not my fault. She might have been there 6 hours, but her actual deposition testimony was actually 3 hours and 39 minutes. So not 8 hours. Anyway, so the discovery abuses had gone on for years. We tried everything, and it ended up that we had to file three motions, one in front of the discovery commissioner and then the two in front of the judge, Judge Johnson. The first one in front of Judge Johnson, she ordered the $2,500 sanction and that they sit for their deposition within 30 days, the 30 days to be before July 19, 2009. They didn't make that date. We tried to make them have that date. That's why we set it for July 3rd, which was a Friday, the non-judicial date that just happened to be a Friday. We worked. I had a videographer there, a court reporter there, an attorney there, and office staff there. And it wasn't because it was a non-judicial date. It was just the date that we could get it set. But they didn't pay the sanction. They didn't appear. And I told them, if you don't appear, you don't have a protective order, I'm going to make a record, and I'm going to bring my motion back. And that's what I did. And they didn't have a protective order.
Does the fact that they had an application for a protective order go to the whole how willful it was?
I dispute that, Your Honor, because I don't think that they actually had an application in. There were two motions pending in front of the commissioner. They had a motion pending, and we had a motion pending, which dealt with IMEs. Those motions were on an order shortening time. They did not, I think they were trying to piggyback one of those motions to this motion on the protective order, but I don't think that they, my records indicate they did not have a signed protective order or a signed order shortening time at the time that this deposition was set to be heard. And I did not feel that having a conference call with the discovery commissioner was not going to make any difference, since that would not give us a record. And counsel himself said that he felt like it was an effort of futility because we're going to disagree. Well, if we don't have a record, you know, it's still going to be his interpretation versus my interpretation of what the discovery commissioner said. We needed a record. In order to have a record, we need a hearing. In order to have a hearing, he needs to file a motion for protective order. And the order came out of the district court. He never even tried to file an order in front of the district court to get a protective order with the district court. He went to the discovery commissioner. And I don't, the district court trumps the discovery commissioner when it comes to that. And one more thing, the discovery commissioner, I'm going to dispute what he said, because the discovery commissioner did not limit that deposition. She did talk about that later, but she said that I could ask the plaintiff, and I cite this in my brief, her testimony on the record, she said that defendants are allowed to inquire into the treatment and care that was germane to the action against Dr. Peoples, even if it would result in duplicative questions from the first deposition. That's what she said in her statement, or that's what the recording said. And I just want to point that out to you because I think their brief says something else, that she completely granted their protective order. And that's not true. That isn't what happened. And anyway, I think that there's substantial evidence to support what the district court did, that my client is and was irreparably harmed, that the interminable delays happened, that there was no evidentiary hearing requested, and that there is substantial evidence to support the heightened standard of review that this court can give this order, and that on the order, on the hearing, they asked for the court to amend the findings of fact and conclusions of law.
Please finish your thought.
The court had the hearing and did an amended findings of fact, wrote them out, and addressed all the Stubley factors and did a concise briefing on all the issues. So I think it should be upheld.
Thank you, Ms. Everhart.
Thank you.
I thought counsel exhausted his time. Did he?
Well, I thought I had 2 minutes. Did I go through the 2 minutes?
You did.
Oh, okay.
Thank you. This matter will stand submitted, and the court will be in recess. Thank you.
All rise.